March 3rd, 2021 was, in a lot of ways, the best day of my entire life. It's the day I found out that I was a dad. My wife, Jessica, gave me this paper bag that contained a couple things that would change my life forever. And I was in utter shock. Whether you have been expecting this positive test, or whether you've been waiting on it, or whether it was a complete and overwhelming surprise, I think that the correct reaction to a positive pregnancy test is shock, for first-time parents especially. For us, it quickly turned to joy, and my voice got all high and squeaky, and my voice caught in my throat, and I asked, "Are you serious?" And she said, "Yes." We held each other and we cried. This wasn't the first time around this time every month that we had held each other and cried. For 3 years, we had held each other and cried. But those were not tears of joy. Those were tears of hurt and disappointment and heartbreak. Those were tears of people asking God, "Are you seriously not going to allow us to be parents?" See, infertility is a lot like singleness. When you're single, you feel like everybody else has someone. Like everybody. Like even that dude that's sitting at the red light picking his nose. Yeah, that guy even has somebody. "Hey, buddy, we can see you." When you're trying to get pregnant, it feels like everybody has a baby. And some people even say it's an accident. But if you've ever been through the fourth grade body changes video or eighth grade health, you kind of know how this happens. So it's not really an accident, but I digress. Infertility and singleness make you feel utterly alone. Like no one sees you. No one hears you. And no one knows you, not even God. And people will say well-meaning things like, "Oh, just wait, it'll happen." Or, "Oh, you know, eventually you'll find something." And here's the deal, guys, that's not a promise. It's not a promise that everyone will find a spouse and that everybody who wants to be parents will get to be one. So what do we do in the middle, in the waiting? The time between God either does a miracle or he gives you grace to accept the plan that he has for your life. Today, I want to talk about a story about being in the middle of loneliness. It's from the book of Genesis, which is the very first collection of stories in the Bible. So if you have your Bible, I'd love for you to open it up to Genesis chapter 16. If you don't worry. The words will be on the screen. They'll also be on your phone in the BPF app. We're going to jump into the middle of a story of a guy named Abram. Now, God had promised Abram that he would make of Abram's descendants a great nation. And his descendants would number more than the stars in the sky. And that they would be a blessing to every other nation on earth. But here's the thing. Abraham didn't have any kids. And he was really old. He was about 90 at this time. His wife Sarai was about 80. Don't make children that old very often. How could Sarai and Abram birth a nation if they couldn't even birth a single child? Let's look at chapter 16, verse 1. It says this. Now Sarai and Abram's wife had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now she knows she is pregnant. She despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." "Your slave is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." Then Sarai mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. Let me start by saying this. Abram, who would go on to be known as Abraham, is in the hall of fame of faith. In fact, God chose to redeem all of humankind through the line of Abraham. Eventually, he would be a man who would be revered for his faith and his character. This ain't one of those times. At this point, Abram is still going through learning how to be like God has created us to be. So I'm going to be a little harsh on him and Sarai, but I think they kind of deserve it in this instance. But we should have hope that God redeems even the worst of us, and he is faithful even when we are awful. So Sarai sees a problem. She knows that Abram needs an heir in order to fulfill God's promise. But it's just not happening. Abram and Sarai are battling with infertility. I know what that's like. The difference here is that God has promised Abram descendants. He spoke to Abram and he told him, "I will give you a child." Most of us will never experience a promise quite that clearly, so we can probably understand what Sarai does next. She gets impatient. She doesn't trust that God will fulfill his promise, and she definitely doesn't trust in his timeline. Our impatience shows a lack of faith in God's control, and we assume that he needs our help. If you're taking notes, I'd love for you to write this down. Believe God's promises and trust in his timing. Sarai was getting old, and desperation was starting to set in. Her impatience convinced her that God's timing was off, and she must step in to correct this failure. She looks around at what she has at her disposal, determined to take control, but she fails to believe in God's promises and trust in his timing. But she owns a slave named Hagar. And at that time in the ancient Near East, slaves could be given to whomever, however the owner sees fit. Now, let me take a quick aside here. This is a description of how life was, not how life should be. The Bible does not endorse, nor does it condone slavery in any form. This is just a biblical author capturing a story as it actually happened. So Sarai takes Hagar, gives her to Abram to sleep with in order to conceive. Now, this is actually a practice that is popular at the time in the ancient Near East because an heir was essential to pass on land and wealth. And so normally rich men would take an extra person to help in the conception process. So it's very offensive to us now, but it was kind of an accepted practice then. However, the women that would be forced into this conception wouldn't be able to raise the child. The child would be raised by the father and his wife in order to keep their line going. But the first evidence of grace of God is shown here in verse 3. Sarai could have just ordered Hagar to sleep with Abram, but instead, Abram took Hagar as a wife. And through that small act, God would take care of Hagar for the rest of her life. Abram had a vision in chapter 15, which God reaffirmed to Abram his promise to make of Abram a great nation. Now, Abram should have trusted more than anybody else in the story, because this message was delivered personally to him. Now, you could argue that Abram maybe thought, "Man, my wife is a genius. Why didn't I think of this?" Ironically, this is a phrase that is uttered in the Searles household quite often, but unlike in the Searles household, this was not a genius idea. This was a selfish one. Abram should have refused, but he didn't. He looked at this young, vulnerable slave girl with no power to withhold or give consent in the situation, and he decides, "This is how I'll bring about God's promises. I surely know better than God." No, Abram didn't. Now, I'm taking a little bit of a pessimistic view of this situation, but I'm not doing it without good reason. So the writer of Genesis actually parallels this story with a story back in Genesis chapter 3. It's a story about a woman giving something to her husband. Her husband should have known better and said no and refused, but he doesn't. He takes what is offered, and it ends very badly. The story to which I'm referring is the story of sin entering the world, of Adam and Eve eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So, because the writer of Genesis 16 and the writer of Genesis 3 are the same, we can see the narrative devices and the parallel language and know that this author believed that this was a doomed bad choice from the start. Abram's decision to go through with this plan seems to work, though. Hagar becomes pregnant, but it sours really quickly. Hagar begins to resent Sarai, but for good reason. See, this child that Hagar was forced to conceive would not build her own family, but would build Sarai's. So tension begins to build heavily, and Sarai begins to blame Abram for the hatred that she receives. Now, Abram here has another chance to do what's right. He has another chance, but he fails. See, what he should do as a good husband is lead one wife into grace and mercy to protect the other. But he chickens out, and he just says, do whatever you want. Now, another just quick aside, the Bible also doesn't promote polygamy. In fact, the Bible shows over and over and over how only heartache and hurt will come from that. This is just, again, a snapshot of what happened. So Sarai continues to take things into her own hands and out of God's. And we, like Sarai, often cannot truly believe that God is in control. So we take more and more and more things onto ourselves and out of God's hands, though God is inviting us to do the exact opposite. He says to cast our cares and our burdens on him. If you're writing notes, I'd love for you to write this down as well. We should be putting things into God's hands, not ours. If we believe in God's promises and trust in his timing, it's really easy to put things or to leave things in God's hands because they were there in the first place. But humans aren't great at that. While we're waiting on God to do his part, sometimes all we can do is sit and wait and trust. In our infertility journey, we did this as well. We explored every option we could, and we continued to pray and listen and lean in to what God had. And we would have done anything that he asked us to do, but we had to sit and wait and trust. We were desperate, just like Abram and Sarai. But impatience always prompts unhelpful solutions. We've spent a lot of time focusing on Abram and Sarai so far, but the story really hinges on Hagar, the slave girl, sold from her home in Egypt, forced to serve a foreign master, given without consent into a sexual relationship, forced to conceive a child that she would not call her own, treated so poorly because of what she was forced to do that she runs away, trying to go back to a home that she has no guarantee of safe haven in. Pregnant, afraid, and alone. But then we see God show up for the first time in the story. Verse 7 says this: the angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress Sarai, she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The angel added, I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count. The God of the universe goes out to find this woman who has been treated as property with no compassion, stripped of her dignity in order to show her compassion and restore her dignity. This phrase, the angel of the Lord, can mean a lot of things, but what it definitely and always means is that it is a physical manifestation of God's grace. When the angel of the Lord appears, he almost always brings good news and salvation or rescue. Here, the angel brings both. See, even though the child that was in Hagar's womb wouldn't be the promised child to Abraham, God promises to preserve this child and make a nation of him. At Hagar's most alone, God seeks her out and offers her lasting rescue, because that is what God is in the business of doing, rescuing broken people. In fact, in the next verse, the angel gives this yet-to-be-born child a name, Ishmael, which means God hears. God heard the cries of a scared mother alone in the wilderness, and he came to her to extend his grace. And then Hagar does something that no one to this point in history has done. She gives God a name. There are lots of names for God throughout the Bible, most of them given by leaders of the faith, leaders of the Israelite people, men and women of revere. But the first person to name God is a scared, pregnant slave girl from Egypt. Verse 13 says this: "She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, 'You are the God who sees me.' For she said, 'I have now seen the one who sees me.'" The God who sees me. El Roi. Isn't that powerful? How overwhelming for an Egyptian slave to see a physical manifestation of God and know that God sees her. Friends, God sees you. Friend who lost someone to the pandemic, God sees you. Mama begging that God will allow you to hold a baby, God sees you. Dad who's laying awake at night wondering how he's going to get through another day, God sees you. Single person waiting so faithfully for a spouse, God sees you. Student who has the weight of the world on your shoulders and wondering if anyone in the whole world cares about you, God sees you. We serve a God who sees you. In your brokenness, in your pain, in your darkest hour, he sees you, and you are not alone. If March 3rd was the best day of my life, March 16th was the worst. Jess had begun to bleed a few days before. We were afraid that our worst fears had come true. So I dropped her off in front of a giant white building, and I watched her walk alone and afraid into a hospital, not knowing what the doctor would say. I drove a few blocks until I found a place to park, and then the weight of days and weeks of worry proved to be too much, and I broke down. My body heaved, sobs so deep that they felt like they came from every cell of my body, and I cried every tear that my body contained. I cried out to God and prayed harder than I ever had prayed that God would save my baby. Why would he give us such an amazing gift just to rip it away? And my phone rang, and I heard the doctor begin the ultrasound, and she knew immediately. There wasn't a baby there anymore. We had lost our child. Her name was Mercer. This child we had waited for, this child that we had prayed for, this child that we loved more than anyone on earth was gone. I sat in my car, scared, alone, and broken. Jessica sat on a cold exam room table, scared, alone, and broken. I didn't know if we would ever be okay again. In the next few moments and days, we had a lot of hard choices to make, but the hardest for me was whether God still loved me, whether he cared for me, whether his grace was enough for me. Was God good? Was he ever good? Friends, I can tell you the answer was overwhelmingly yes. In those moments of absolute brokenness, God saw me. In those moments of heartbreak, he was there. In the moments when I couldn't stand, he held me. In moments when I couldn't fight, he fought for me. And he did this from a place of love and compassion and experience, because God knows what it's like to lose a child too. The God who sustains the universe went through this same heartbreak too. He sent his son to die alone on a cross so you and I would never have to be alone again. See, the phrase, the angel of the Lord, that we saw earlier, often means that Jesus, God's son, before he was born in a manger to come save the world forever, was coming to rescue. I hope this fact comforts you as much as it does me. If you stepped over the line of faith, the creator of all things is with you and in you and for you. Just like he was there with Hagar in the wilderness. Just like he was with me on the streets of Seattle. Just like he was with Jess on that cold exam room table. God is with you. If you haven't taken that next step to step over the line of faith, I would love to talk to you about how to do that. I'm going to be over in the prayer corner there. I'd love to introduce you to this Jesus who came to die so that we would not be alone. The city of Seattle is full of people who don't know this grace that I've described. The pandemic and the physical and social isolation that it has caused has hit us hard. People are still hiding in their homes and behind masks, not feeling like anyone sees them, hears them, or knows them. Not even God. I firmly believe that this is why God asked Jessica and I to move now to start a church. The message of the gospel, the truth that we are seen and heard and known by the one and true God of the universe, is resonating so deeply in the hearts of people. Jess and I are not alone anywhere that we go, but many of our neighbors are. They do not know this hope that they are so desperately searching for. They're alone, but they don't have to be. To borrow a phrase from Jesus, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Friends, yes, God sees you, and he hears you, and he knows you, but we cannot sit and soak this in for ourselves. That love compels us to tell others about it. Love like this cannot just stay in our hearts. It must move our affections to actions. As this next song plays, I want you to think about this question. How can I make people feel seen, heard, and known this week? Not in the future, this week. Maybe even go further and ask if God is asking you to show people in the city of Seattle that they are seen and heard and known so that they can see and hear and know God. There are 724,305 hearts on the line. This mission is not just important, it is essential. How can we be the physical manifestation of God's grace to them? So this is what we can do in the in-between, in the waiting, the time between either God does a miracle or he gives us the grace to understand his plan. We can help people be seen and heard and known. This is coming from someone who is still in the middle, in the waiting. April 24th, I found out I was a dad again. But that didn't tie a bow around everything. That didn't make it feel like I wasn't alone. In fact, every day, Jessica and I pray that there will be a pregnancy symptom so we know that our child is still alive. Every day we are afraid. Every day we feel alone. Every day I ask myself, how can I be a good father while being a good husband, while being a good servant to the city of Seattle as a pastor? But God sees me. And because he sees me, I have made it my life's mission to help others feel seen, heard, and known. Will you join me on that mission?